He's the former deputy leader of the Labour Party and was once nicknamed Tommy Two Dinners. Tom Watson developed type 2 diabetes after gaining a lot of weight over many years. He then lost 8 stone and reversed his diagnosis. I've been chatting to Tom about his new book, which is called Downsizing, and he started by telling me why he ignored his weight issues for so long.
I think I'm not unique in that. I was just in a denial, and I was frightened about what having type 2 diabetes meant and what the consequences of being overweight was. I had a busy job that I used as an excuse not to address my own health. But it was a tiny little voice that started to say, if you don't do this, you're going to die. And then over time, it became a very loud voice. And I started to read biographies of my sort of colleagues and predecessors, a lot of Labour leaders who and senior politicians who died in their 50s. And I turned 50. I've got two young kids, Malachi and Saoirse, and I wanted to live for them. So after years of denial, I couldn't ignore it anymore. Yeah. I treat myself as a sugar addict now. And like a lot of people who have addictions, I guess you have to hit rock bottom, or they often say you have to hit rock bottom before you finally make a sort of turn a mental switch in your head.
And what was rock bottom for you? How big did you get, for example?
When I finally plucked up enough courage to buy some new bathroom scales, I was 22 stone. But I think I was probably more than that. And the weight started to come off a bit before I really seriously engaged. And I had hypertension. I had type 2 diabetes. It was very... I couldn't have done a jog from one lamppost to the other. And I had a very sedentary lifestyle. The greatest Labour Prime Minister we never had, John Smith, he was my hero. John died in his mid-50s, and when I turned 50, I thought, I'm more overweight than John was, and I'm definitely in a more stressful period of political period than John was. I've got to deal with this.
See, you say that you ignored it and you kind of swept it under the carpet to an extent, but I was reading that you were referred to as and it, correct me if this is wrong, because it seems very cruel, but Tommy Two Dinners. What was it, a nickname people had for you?
It was a nickname that sort of stuck after after I had a lunch with some journalists that ended up turning into dinner in the same restaurant, and so they called me Two Dinners. But it obviously stuck with me. And one of the other things that it did, I was always, obviously when you're a politician, you're open to satirists and cartoonists.
Yeah.
But I was mercilessly lampooned in the cartoons. They made me ginormous. The guy from The Guardian, he actually described me as the Fatberg, which is interesting because I'm not sure if he would have treated female politicians in the same way, even in a cartoon format. It led to a lot of stereotyping because of my sort of weight and the way I presented myself.
So you've lost 7 stone. You reversed your type 2 diabetes diagnosis, which you were given at a party, basically, by a doctor, but at a party.
Yeah, I've actually lost 8 stone now.
8.
It was at a Christmas party. A friend from the civil service had gathered a sort of her old colleagues together, and a clinician, a very successful dermatologist, actually. He very gently took me to one side and said, look, I don't know when you last had a blood test, but I think you should go to your GP and get one if you haven't.
And had you met this man before then?
Very briefly, but not to talk to.
Said, Tom, you're in trouble.
He did, yeah. I asked him why. He said, and what I now know is sort of when you're type 2 diabetic, not all diabetic, type 2 diabetics are like this. About 2/3 of us have a sort of layer of, like a sort of tire around the belly that sort of sticks out, sort of pot belly with a sort of layer of fat around it. And I was sort of a bit sweaty and clammy and looking, a little bit sort of out of it. And he guessed that I'd had trouble controlling my blood glucose. And He did it very gently and politely, but I think he could well have saved my life because he sort of gave me the nudge I needed. And
my goodness.
I obviously went to my GP and he confirmed what was probably obvious to many.
Not what you expect to happen when you go to a party and you're schmoozing and having a drink and chatting with friends to someone to diagnose you with something that could be really serious to your health.
Well, for me, it was also, I mean, it was a cruel blow because even though I'm relatively well-read and informed, when you get a diagnosis of type 2 diabetes, I thought it was a chronic, lifelong condition that couldn't be addressed. And I was immediately medicalized and sort of put it to one side. I didn't want to think about it. I was so overwhelmed by the diagnosis. But when I finally started to read into it, I realized that actually you can reverse the condition if you change your nutrition and you live a slightly more active life. And I guess now that I've left politics, if I've got a new mission in life, you know, in the United Kingdom, there are 3.4 million type 2 diabetics that have been identified, probably another million that haven't. And the research shows that 2 million of those can do what I did, reverse their condition. So I want to dedicate some of my time now to working with those people to try and give 2 million type 2s the joy of remission.
Would you say, when you reflect back now, that you had a food addiction?
It's difficult to describe. I certainly had a very unhealthy relationship with food. I mean, in the book Downsizing, I refer to a number of examples. The one that sort of horrifies everyone is I was in a restaurant.
Yeah.
My friend came to meet me and saw me unconsciously leaning into the next table and eating cake off a plate on the next table.
I read
and I didn't
that.
Know I was doing
I
it.
Couldn't believe that. It was rainbow cake off someone. Oh, they had left the table. They weren't still sitting at the table, I take it.
Yeah, but it was still someone else.
Well, it was still it was leftover food in a cafe and you were eating someone's leftovers. Did you know them?
Yeah. I didn't know who they were. And
I
didn't even know I was doing it.
How can you not know you're eating someone else's food, Tom?
Well, I think that obviously shows I was a sugar addict and I was just filling myself up with sugar. And there's another story where it was actually a family member. I emailed all my friends when I was writing the book and said, look, do you remember ever eating with me? Have you got any anecdotes? And my inbox just immediately filled up. And one story was, you know, they just remember me. I was always on the phone. You know, I'd knock on the door. They'd answer the door. And all they could hear was the fridge squeaking open as I was sort of subconsciously filling my mouth with food whilst I was talking to people on the phone. And again, that's kind of unconscious eating. And I now know that's just, you know, I now realise, you know, by the time I hit 50, I just thought I was a naturally greedy person. I thought I needed to eat. I was hungry every minute of every hour of every day for 30 years.
Yeah, and then I guess it comes back to, you know, when you actually are hungry. I think a lot of us are rarely very hungry. We're in the habit of eating. We're in the routines. It's breakfast time. It's lunch time. It's dinner time. Are you actually hungry? Not quite sure. For example, what we're in January, I don't think I've been hungry. I don't mean to make light of it. Since, I don't know, maybe sometime in November, I've ate so much over December and January, and we normalise it and say, it's okay, it's festive, it's Christmas, you're allowed to do that.
Yeah, and I guess for me, it's a little bit about control. So like everyone, you know, I let the boat out a little bit over Christmas, put a few pounds on, and I'm now glad to say it's already off again. But in previous Christmases, I would have just sort of not known what I'd eaten, probably, you know, but I'd have eaten everything that was put in front of me.
So how did you do it then? How did you reverse your type 2 diabetes? What was your diet like? What was your exercise like?
What I first did was give up refined sugar. I mean, if you're diabetic, you can't eat refined sugar. That's just the end of it. And what I now know myself as, what I'd had for 30 years was 3 hourly sugar spikes where my blood sugars had gone up and then dropped, and then I'd filled it with sugar. And then after that, I lowered the carbohydrate level and increased the fat level in my macronutrients. And that was the hard thing, because I actually broke public health guidelines there, having read the work of Dr. Michael Mosley and Dr. Aseem Malhotra. And that helped me get through sugar cravings. And when I did that, I started to get better. straight away, really. I slept better, my cognition was better, the weight started to come off, and that allowed me to just draw down on more energy and begin to make decisions about leading a more active life.
You told Radio 4 that you felt great, you felt younger, you felt like you were more chilled out, and that your IQ had gone up.
Yeah, I feel very privileged because at the age of 53, it's my birthday today.
Happy birthday.
Thank you very much. I'm the happiest I've ever been. I feel like I'm in equilibrium for the first time, perhaps ever. And the gains I got from improving my physical health, it's actually the cognition gains. I can draw down on facts more. It's like a brain fog has lifted.
Yeah.
I'm more in the moment. And it's a joyful feeling. And I never want to lose that. And I want others to feel like I feel, because I know what it's like when you've got a sort of brain fog related to sugar, and it's hard to get out of it. And I want to talk to people who will want to start that journey as well.
What about when you found out that you had reversed the diabetes? How did that come about, and how did that feel?
Well, it was like just an amazing moment, a real milestone in life. And actually, I there are two ways type 2 diabetics can test their blood. They can do a daily fasting blood sugar test where they just prick their finger and test the blood, or they can go to their GP and have their longer range blood sugars measured. And when I was doing the finger prick test, I was basically getting into average ranges within 6 to 8 weeks, but I left it a year to make sure that it was consistent. And when I finally had my test at the GP, Dr. Nazir, a lovely man, he was so proud of me, having told me off for many years, that he gave me a little hug, because he said I was his star patient. And it was a real moment for the two of us, because I think we were both amazed that I'd actually done it.
So have you reached your target weight, or are you still trying to lose more? Because we hear people say when they diet, sometimes the hardest thing is then maintaining that loss when you get to your target.
Yeah, I don't really. I'm 8 stone lighter now. I'm just below 14 stone, and I sort of over Christmas I just bobbled over, and I've just pulled it sort of back down again. I don't need to worry about my weight anymore, even though I keep an eye on it. What I try and do is just stay healthy. So I've got slightly different measurements. Like, you know, I take long walks, and if I feel okay on there, I know I'm in good order. But I never want to go back to a cycle where I feel like I've lost control of my eating and my diet, because I know that I'll get ill again if I do that.
Yeah. And just to go back briefly into the training, so cycling, running, boxing, weight training, do you enjoy all that?
Yeah, and I mix and match. I mean, when I first started, the first target I set myself was 5,000 steps a day, which is tiny, but that's
kind of
quite
is,
hard.
Tom. One of them watches on myself, and well, my dad, who is in his 60s, he works as an electrician, and he kind of averages around 14,000, 15,000 a day, and makes both me and you look very lazy.
Yeah, well, that's great. I mean, I now try and get 12,000, and if I kick myself if I don't get 10. And then the second rule I set for myself was that I'd walk up every staircase I came to, and not take the lift. And that was a bit of a problem because I made the rule, and then they moved me in the House of Commons, and my office was 64 steps up. And so I remember the first time I walked up those stairs, and I felt like I would need an oxygen mask halfway up. These days it's okay. I started with tiny little steps and just built on that to the point where, you know, I now get out on the bike and ride around London or the Midlands just to get about, and it's a great feeling.
Let's talk about work. You quit your position in November. Why did you leave?
I ran out of road, really. The decision came on me quite quickly because of the election. And I just thought I'm not going to be able to sort of shape the direction of my party in the way I have done in previous years. There's a new generation behind me. I'd seen a lot of politicians retire too late, going in their 70s and 80s, and they would always go bitter and unfulfilled and angry. And I didn't want to be that person. Yeah. I thought at 52, there are other things I could do. I'm very privileged that I've got other opportunities. And so I took a leap.
Well, of course, with the general election a couple of weeks away from that date, there will be some that might say, well, maybe from a cynical point of view, well, Tom, you might have foresaw what was going to happen, the outcome, the loss of 50-odd seats, and you jumped ship before it sank.
Well, I didn't think my party were going to win because, the polls, they sometimes miss the bullseye, but they're usually in the right area. And the polls were showing we were going to lose. If I'm being honest, I wasn't surprised that we lost very badly. But that's not the reason I went. I had a great sense of obligation and duty in the job I did as deputy leader. And one of the things I was trying to do was hold the Labour Party together. It's a century-old institution.
But you did that by quitting.
Well, but that's part of it, yeah. I mean, I think I'd probably expended a lot of political capital in a very chaotic period for the Labour Party that would have meant it would have been harder for me to manoeuvre after the election.
Do you think did you damage the party and their chances in the election by leaving so close to that polling day?
I hope I didn't, because I left without rancour. I didn't have a scorched earth policy on the way to the exit door. I was very honest about that it was a personal decision for me, and it really was.
Yeah.
You know, there's 100 things you weigh up when you decide to do those things, and I wasn't sure. The day I resigned, I went to bed that night and thought, if I wake up tomorrow and I regret this, it'll be the worst day of my life. But I woke up and the sun was shining. And the page had turned. I was an ex-politician, and there was a massive weight off my shoulders. And that weight is about to be applied to the shoulders of a new leader, a deputy leader. And good luck to that.
Yourself and Jeremy Corbyn, you seemed to part on fairly good terms, but you were at loggerheads over the period when you were in that position. What do you really make of him?
Yeah, I mean, a lot is written about relationships in politics, and it's always more complicated and nuanced than sort of the description. We never raised our voices with each other, Jeremy and me, and we got on personally very well. He was very kind to my children. I knew his family. So it was always very courteous and friendly. But obviously, we sort of represented different traditions.
Yeah.
And I bore the brunt of some of the sort of political rows with his sort of political faction. But I never bore a grudge against him or held that against him. And I think he was the same with me. It's just that I consider myself a pro-European social democrat. He was sort of represents a tradition that has a sort of different view. Yeah. Of the economy and things like that.
But do you think has he done a good job as leader? Are you sorry to see him go?
Well, he was true to himself, I think.
That's a politician's answer if ever.
No, it's not. I mean, obviously, he and I are collectively responsible for losing two general elections. We can't run away from that. We can't hide it. I mean, that's failure. But what I'm really keen not to happen in this period is I think there are a lot of people who will hang the defeat solely on Jeremy Corbyn's peg. And actually, the entire shadow cabinet and the National Executive Committee of the Labour Party signed up to the last two manifestos. And those candidates in the leadership election who were involved in that manifesto, they've got to explain themselves as well. They've got to explain to the country why they thought that manifesto was an election-winning formula.
Okay.
Otherwise, Labour's never going to win again.
The leadership candidate, Rebecca Long-Bailey, gave Jeremy Corbyn 10 out of 10 in terms of his reign as leader. What would you give him?
I'm definitely not going to give you a score, and that is a politician's answer.
Why not? It's your birthday. I think you can say what you want on your birthday, Tom, just between me and you.
Because I think he deserves to explain himself, and he doesn't want me to go. You know, it's not right for me to go around judging Jeremy. I mean, people could draw their own conclusions to that, but I think they'll draw a conclusion that Rebecca Long Bailey is definitely the continuity Corbyn candidate in this race, which is perfectly legitimate. But the, you know, she's got an even greater responsibility to explain why, you know, she thinks that, you know, carrying on in the way we've gone on will be electorally successful next time round.
Just as we come towards the end of our chat, Tom, going back to when you resigned, and around that time I was reading about the death threat. The police contacted you to say, we've arrested someone. They assumed you knew what they were talking about, but they didn't.
Yeah, the police investigator dealing with the case rang me up and said, look, we've arrested him. You know, what do you want to, how do you want to play it? And the death threat had gone in to our party HQ, but they'd not told me about it, which was a bit of a surprise.
Were they trying to protect you?
I just don't think they... I don't know. I mean, I honestly... The General Secretary said she gave me a very confused answer. They just didn't tell me. And obviously that was a concern because, you know, I don't need to tell people that... You know, we lost a loved colleague a few years ago after a far right extremist assassinated Joe. So it did worry everyone. So it wasn't great. But I try not to talk about these security issues because for me there are people who are targeted more greatly than me, and there are people who've been through the more pain and loss as a result of
course.
These kind of threats.
Although, of course, it's totally up to you whether you answer this or not, but in the 30-odd years in frontline politics, is that something that was regular? Was it common? Politicians tend to be the target of a lot of criticism, but in terms of actual death threats?
Well, I think there is definitely an increase in physical threats to politicians. We're in a very intolerant political period. And I think a lot of female politicians in particular are targeted with very violent sounding, threatening language that is scarring the character of politics. And I know at least one colleague who changed their vote in a division lobby because they were worried about threats. So it does matter. Security does matter, and it does have an impact on the language, tone, and the way people conduct themselves in public life.
Tom, I've enjoyed talking to you this morning. Congrats on the weight loss and the health gains, I suppose we should call them. The book is called Downsizing, and it's out now. Tom, thanks.
Thank you very much, and thanks for calling.